So, good morning, everybody, or good evening, depending where you are. So, today is Vesak in the Chinese tradition, I think Vietnamese as well, and it's an auspicious day to start a new teaching. So, we're going to be starting to discuss Shanti Deva's Bodhicharya Avatara. The title is sometimes translated as engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds, sometimes as engaging in the Bodhisattva conduct. What else? Guide to a Bodhisattva's way of life. So there's several different English translations. And I have one in the text that I'm using, but I may look at other ones as well. So that's okay. Whatever translation you use, it's fine. It's interesting to hear different translations because they will give you different, different perspective on what's going on. And then you may prefer some translations over others because they really speak to your heart and get you going. But Shanti Deva's text in general is quite a powerful one. And if you really think about the verses, it moves your heart, it moves your mind. You can't help that, because he's quite forceful, quite direct, and makes us be honest with ourselves, which I really appreciate. Shanti Deva does not coddle us and say, "Oh, you poor little thing, be compassionate to yourself, don't be hard on yourself, enjoy samsara a little bit, it's okay." Shanti Deva doesn't talk to us like that. Yeah, he goes, "Look what you're doing. Look at the results of it. And check if you want to keep doing that. And if you don't, I'll show you the way to change. And here's how you do it. And you practice with energy and sincerity and no excuses." And I don't know about you, but I need that approach. Because otherwise, I kind of loll around in samsara and, in the name of self-compassion, I get very lazy, although that's not self-compassion at all. It's just plain old laziness. And, Shanti Deva calls me out on it. So there's always a story that is told at the beginning of teaching this text, which I just told last week, but I'll tell it again. And of all these kind of stories, there's several different versions. So, So Shanti Deva was an Indian monk in the 8th century. And at his monastery, he was known as the one who did three things: eat, sleep, and go to the bathroom. Except there weren't bathrooms then. So go to the toilet, go to the hole in the ground, But that's what he was known as because he kind of stayed to himself and meditated and looked like he was sleeping and kind of disregarding monastery rules and so on. So the monks were not too happy with him and they wanted to expel him, but of course they needed an excuse to do that. So they arranged for him to teach a text and they built a very high throne because you always put the Dharma teacher on a high throne. And Shanti Deva, with the idea that he wouldn't be able to get on the throne because they didn't put steps. And then he would be embarrassed and humiliated, and then he would leave. Okay. So Shantideva came up and, you know, he fooled all these guys because the throne was quite high and he just put his hand on it and made the throne go lower, sat on it, and then raised it up again. And then he taught this text, you know, Bodhicharyavatara. And when he reached the 9th chapter, which is about emptiness, then he floated up in the air. So at the end, all they could hear was his voice somewhere in the sky. They couldn't even see him. So they couldn't kick him out of the monastery after that. But it's said that he left and he became a wandering mendicant. But nothing more is really known about his life after that, although he did put together another text called Sutra Samuchaya, Shiksha Samuchaya, the compendium of advice. Okay. And so in going through this text, we're going to use Gyaltsub Jay's commentary. So Gyaltsub Jay, also known as Gyaltsub Dharma Rinchen, was a disciple of Jason Kapa. And there's an interesting story about him too, and there's also several versions of this story. Mm-hmm. But Gyaltsub Jay was already a recognized master in Tibet. And then Jason Kapa came along, and he was, you know, one of these youngins who became quite well known when he was young because of his astuteness regarding the scriptures and the teachings that the Buddha propounded. And so he was, a lot of people were going to Jason Kapa's teachings. So Gyaltsub Jay thought, well, I better go and check out this young guy. You know, he probably thinks he's really something and he doesn't really know much. So Jason Kapa was teaching and Gyaltsub Jay walks in and sits on the throne next to him, which is not what you do, you know. But, you know, he's a big guy and who's this little pipsqueak. So he sits on the throne next to him and he listens to Jason Kapa's teachings. And as he listens, then he moves himself down a little bit. And then he listens more, and he moves himself down a little bit more. And then finally he was sitting on the floor as one of Jason Kapa's students. Okay, so Tsongkhapa had two major disciples. I mean, many, many disciples, but two major ones, Gyaltsub Jay and Kedrup Jay. When you look at the statue of Gyaltsub Jay, of Tsongkhapa, as we look at it, Gyaltsub Jay is on the left and Kedrup Jay, who looks a little bit fierce, he's on the right. But Gyaltsub Jay was older than Tsongkhapa. He was a very prolific teacher and writer himself. He authored commentaries on many, many, many texts that are still followed today. And of course, Bodhicharyavatara is one of those texts. We have, due to Venerable Phaedo's kindness in translating it, we have an English translation of Gyaltsub Jay's commentary. And I was thinking I could just teach this in a very traditional way and like start at the beginning of the commentary and read each line and go through it like that. Or I could just do it like verse to verse and kind of use the outlines to make sure we are identifying everything correctly. And I thought to do it the latter way because that way, you know, it's easier to talk and make examples from our life and so on. And then probably you'll have the opportunity to hear it in the traditional way, reading the commentary from a Tibetan Lama later on. Okay, but we will go through some of the, a few of the things in the commentary. So I thought first to, there's a summary of the text that Gyaltsen J wrote that's in the commentary. And I thought to read that because it's very nice to have a summary so that we know where we're going in the text. Okay, so Gyaltsen J says, this commentary shows the complete stages of the path to awakening. It shows the training in the thoughts of the small and middling beings as preliminaries for the training in the thought of the great capable beings. Okay, so it's showing when we talk about the Lamrim and divide it into teachings suitable for beings of three capacities, the initial level being, the middle level being, and the advanced level being. So this commentary is covering all three levels. Yeah. So the initial level being, yeah, that's somebody who is first developing, you know, knowledge of the Dharma, and they meditate on precious human life, on death and impermanence, and the three lower realms. And then in the traditional, they meditate on those three, and that instigates in them the wish to attain a good future rebirth. So that's the goal of the initial level person. And to attain that, according to the usual way it's presented, they take refuge and practice karma and its effects. Okay, in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, we moved refuge to the middle level being, yeah, because for many Westerners, it's difficult. The idea of refuge is difficult at the beginning, so we went directly into karma, because karma is actually the way in which you prepare for the future lives by abandoning negativities and creating virtue. Okay, so it's very good to have in your mind, okay, what are the meditations that each level being does, okay, what aspiration they generate because of doing that, and then what meditations or what practice do they do in order to fulfill that aspiration. Okay, so here, you know, on the basis of meditating on precious human life, they meditate on death and impermanence and the lower realms to generate the motivation to attain a good future rebirth, which is the first Dharma motivation. And then the way to accomplish that is by, you can say, either refuge and karma, or as we're presenting it in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, just karma, following karma and its effects. Then for the middle level being, they meditate on the first two of the four truths. So true suffering, true dukkha, and true causes. So that when you meditate on true dukkha, then you have the three kinds of dukkha, the six kinds, the eight kinds, the dukkha in all the six realms of existence, the dukkha in the bardo, all of that, you know, how death is, how people die and are reborn. Yeah, when you meditate on the two causes of dukkha, then you have the whole explanation about the about ignorance and the afflictions and how they operate. And also it goes into karma there too, okay, because on the basis of ignorance and the other afflictions, then we create karma. So, okay, so that's what they meditate on to generate the aspiration for the middle capacity being. And that aspiration is to attain liberation from samsara. Then the third part, the method that they practice to accomplish that, are the last two of the four truths, true cessation and true path. So when we talk about true cessation, we're talking about nirvana and the different levels of cessation that an Arya accomplishes or actualizes as they generate deeper and deeper meditation on the nature of reality, which is the true path. That's the essence of the true path. The true path actually includes all three higher trainings in ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. And the three higher trainings can be divided into the Eightfold Noble Path. Okay, so that's the true path. Those are the last two of the four truths, and they are the Dharma refuge. So that's what you meditate on to accomplish the motivation of the middle level being. Okay. Then the advanced level being, they meditate on equanimity, and then based on that, on one or the other or both of the two ways of generating bodhicitta. So the first method is the seven cause and effect instruction. Okay, so seeing sentient beings as your mother, remembering their kindness, repaying their kindness, heartwarming love, compassion, the great resolve, and then bodhicitta. So that's one method. The other method is equalizing and exchanging self with others. And that one's taught by Shantideva in chapter 9. And it's very, very powerful. And so there we meditate on equalizing self and others, the defects of self-centeredness, the benefits of cherishing others, exchanging self with others, Tonglen, and then bodhicitta. Okay, so those are the meditations you do. What's the aspiration, the motivation that they're trying to generate is the bodhicitta. Yeah, the aspiration to become a fully awakened Buddha in order to benefit all living beings most effectively. And then the motivation the motivation is attaining Buddhahood, okay, for the benefit of all beings. And then the practice that's done is on one hand practicing the bodhisattva's conduct and also tantric practice. So in practicing the bodhisattva's conduct, then we have the 10 perfections, and we also have the four ways of assembling disciples. And then for practicing the tantra, we have the four classes of tantra, but especially the highest yoga tantra. Okay? And so those are the practices that are done in order to actualize that aspiration. The way these three are presented, it encompasses the three capacity beings. It encompasses all living beings. Yeah, often in the initial level being, they include people who are looking only for the happiness of this life, but they don't have the Dharma motivation, but, you know, often they're included there. And so it's said to be a gradual path. You start developing as an initial capacity being, then the middle, then the advanced or the higher level capacity being. And when they explain it in the Lam Rim, since in the Lam Rim, we are all headed, the Lam Rim is designed for those of us who are headed for the advanced level practice, then we say that we practice the initial level in common with the initial level beings. Okay. In other words, we don't practice just that. We practice the path in common with the initial level beings. We practice the path in common with the middle capacity beings. And then based on that, we practice the bodhisattva path for the advanced level beings. Okay. And so you can see how you develop from, going in there with just wanting the happiness of this life to wanting the happiness of future lives, wanting liberation from samsara altogether, and then wanting the awakening of each and every sentient being. Okay, so you can see the gradual development of your mind. And so Gyaltsabje is saying that this text includes all of that. Okay, so I think this is very helpful, because if you've studied the Lam Rim and you know how things go, then you can see how what you're hearing here fits into that structure. Yeah, and that helps us to, just to deepen our practice and understanding how the teachings fit together for one person's practice, instead of, the Lam Rim is here, and Bodhicaryavatara is there, and someone else is here, and how do we put them together? Okay, then we'll have a few minutes of meditation to calm the mind. Then let's generate our motivation. So briefly review the three levels of practitioner, what I just explained, what they meditate on, their aspiration, and what they practice to actualize the aspiration. And the culmination of that is to generate the bodhicitta motivation. And that will be our motivation for listening to the teachings and putting them into practice. So take a couple of minutes to review that and generate your motivation. So that outline I just gave at the beginning, really important to get that fixed in your mind and to know it backwards and forwards. Yeah. Okay. So here's Gyaltsebjay's introduction. I'll start at the beginning again. This commentary shows the complete stages of the path to awakening. It shows the training and the thoughts of the small and middling beings as preliminaries for the training in the thought of the great capable beings. And it shows that having thus generated the mind of supreme awakening, or bodhicitta, one then trains in the six perfections of generosity and so forth. Okay, so that's the three capacity beings right there. Initially, to generate the mind for supreme awakening, one needs to strongly increase joyful strength through contemplating its benefits well. Okay, so contemplating the benefits of bodhicitta well. So this text is, remember, designed for the person who's ultimately going to the advanced level practice. Okay, so talking about the benefits of bodhicitta, that's the sales message. Okay, remember how the Buddha always talks about the disadvantages of one thing and the benefits of others, the other, in order so that we see the benefits and encourages us to practice. Okay, he has to kind of sell us on the method, yeah? Because otherwise, it's like we'll go, well, why should I exert my mind to generate that quality? You know, it's too much effort. So, you know, he has to tell us the benefits. Okay, so this is described in the first chapter, which also shows the trainings in the thoughts of the small and middling beings as limbs for that mind generation. Mind generation means bodhicitta. It's also the translation of Venerable Tsemkhe's name. Yeah, she's Venerable Mind Generation. Okay. Venerable Tarpa is for the middle living being. She is Venerable Moksha, Venerable Liberation. Okay. Okay. Then, so after the first chapter, so then to generate the mind of supreme awakening, or bodhicitta, which has the root of love and compassion, one must first confess the opposing conditions, that is, the obscurations, and one must build up the conducive conditions, that is, the accumulation of merit, the collection of merit. Okay, so this is done on the basis of having cleaned the place of practice, you know, as if one is expecting a wheel-turning king to come for a visit at one's house. So it talks about creating the place to make offerings, but I think, you know, creating the place for practice means also our mind, getting our mind ready. Yeah. So then, on the basis of that, of creating the conducive conditions and eliminating the obscurations, so purification, collection of merit, then one needs to take the bodhisattva, the bodhicitta, or generate the bodhicitta. And so that the former, which is the purification and accumulation merit, is explained in chapter 2, and the latter, the actual generation of bodhicitta, is in chapter 3. And so chapter 3 has one of the ceremonies for generating bodhicitta, and His Holiness often uses this one when he teaches. Then the fourth chapter demonstrates the need for conscientiousness as the factor that prevents the virtues from training in the perfections on bodhicitta from degenerating. Okay, so fourth chapter, conscientiousness. That will help us to stabilize our bodhicitta so that we can actually do the practice of the perfections. Then the next chapters provide the way of training in the six perfections. So the fifth chapter gives extensive instructions on the way of training in ethical conduct by way of protecting one's mind with mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay, so that's the second one. The way of training in fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stabilization, and wisdom are explained in the next four chapters. So chapter six is fortitude, seven, joyous effort, eight, meditative stabilization, and that's where he gives the instructions on equalizing and exchanging self and others, and then wisdom is chapter nine. And then the 10th chapter gives a comprehensive overview of the way of training in generosity. Okay, chapter 10, the last chapter, is the dedication. And it says here that this is the training of generosity. Okay, because we are being generous with our merit. So it explains that with extensive notes on how to train the mind of giving by dedicating one's body, possessions, and virtue to others. The training in generosity is also explained at the time of taking the, or generating the bodhicitta, and so forth. And the resulting Buddhahood is explained in the 9th chapter. That explains emptiness, based on bodhicitta, which will lead us to Buddhahood. Okay. So that's the overview of the text. So the root text starts out talking about the title and the meaning of the title, and then the translator's homage. And then Shantideva gives his expression of worship and and outlines the purpose of the text. So this is kind of standard introductory material for whenever you learn a text by following the commentary. Okay, so the meaning of the title, Bodhicayavatara, I talked about before. Sometimes in Tibetan it's Junjuk, and Juk, can be translated as supplement, as entering, engaging, introduction. There's many different ways of translating it. In this text, the way at least I use it, is engaging in the bodhisattva deeds or bodhisattva's conduct. Okay. Okay. And then translator's homage. We're going to skip for the moment. Wait a minute. And then the third major point is the meaning of the text. So here we start with the expression of worship. So this is Shantideva. So Shantideva says, respectfully, I pay homage to the Sugatas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya, as well as to their children or heirs, and to all who are worthy of homage. Okay, so he's paying homage to the Sugatas. So that means the Buddhas. Now, you may remember the term Sugata from when we studied from Navartika, okay? And so there it was explained the excellences of the three abandonments of a Sugata, and the excellence of the three or the three excellences of the realizations of the Sugata. Okay, so this is also explained in volume 4, yeah, following in the footsteps of the Buddha. Okay, so we're going to look at those. So first, in Pramanavartika, it was when he talks about it in the foreword order, describing how the Buddha is a reliable guide. So he talks about the Buddha's abandonments. Okay, so it has three distinguishing features. Yeah, these are the three excellences or distinguishing features of a Sugata's abandonment, meaning what has the Sugata abandoned? All the afflictions and all the karma that causes rebirth, as well as all the the afflictions are included in the afflictive obscurations, okay, and then the cognitive obscurations that a Buddha has often abandoned. So these three distinctive features or excellences show the excellence of being a Sugata. Okay, so the first one is excellent abandonment, and that indicates that unlike non-Buddhists, yeah, the Buddha has abandoned all afflictions. So non-Buddhists haven't abandoned the afflictions. They don't meditate on emptiness, so impossible to do that. So that's the excellent abandonment. Irreversible abandonment is the second excellence, and that means that these afflictions have been abandoned in such a way that they will never return. Okay, so the Buddha's abandoned afflictions, they will never come back. So this distinguishes the Buddha from the Shravaka Aryas, such as stream enterers and so forth, who are still reborn in samsara due to afflictions and karma. Okay, so, first he's distinguishing how the Buddha is superior to non-Buddhists, now how the Buddha is superior to the Shravaka learners. Learners mean those who are still on the learning path, okay? And in this case, it's referring to the Aryas. Arya is anybody who has seen the ultimate nature directly and non-conceptually. So in the Shravakas, or the hearers, it's sometimes translated as hearers. So they're striving for liberation from samsara. And there are the four levels of Shravaka Aryas, okay? And within the four, there's a pair, the approacher and the abider, okay? So the approacher and the abider to stream entry, approacher and abider to once returner, approacher and abider to non-returner. So those six are the Arya learners of the Shravaka vehicle. And then for Arhat, the fourth is the approacher and the abider to Arhatship. Okay? So I think here it's called irreversible to distinguish it from their realizations. I think this mostly applies to the beginning levels of being a stream enterer, where one has realized emptiness, according to the Prasangika view, but one's practice is not real firm. Okay, and even in the Pali tradition, when they talk about the qualities of the stream entry, you can see that their practice is not as strong as that of the once returners, the non-returners, and the arhats. Okay, so excellent abandonment, how the Buddha is superior to the non-Buddhists who haven't abandoned any of the afflictive obscurations. Irreversible abandonment, meaning that the afflictive obscurations have abandoned so that they'll never return, and that differentiates the Buddha from the hearer learners. And then the third distinctive feature of the abandonment of a Sugata are the complete abandonment, and that shows that all the cognitive obscurations have been abandoned. So that distinguishes the Sugata from the Shravaka arhats, who have also abandoned the afflictive obscurations. Now here within this, you see that he's really discerning the Mahayana path from the Shravaka and solitary realizer vehicles. Okay, but some of these qualities also refer to the lower level bodhisattvas. Okay, the lower level bodhisattvas do not have irreversible abandonment. They don't have complete abandonment. Okay, those on the path of accumulation, path of seeing, don't have the excellent abandonment. They haven't abandoned any of the afflictions at that point. Okay, so here it's really accentuating the Mahayana path, but don't be fooled. He's also differentiating the Buddha's realizations from that of the bodhisattvas who haven't realized emptiness, as well as the Arya bodhisattvas who have. Okay, so that's the excellent abandonment of a Sugata. So going into a little bit more depth about the Sugata that Shantideva is paying homage to, he also has three distinctive qualities of his realizations. Okay, so this Geshe Thapke will teach us this year, because I think he covered the abandonments last year, right? And so when doing the forward order, this time we'll do the reverse order, starting with why the Buddha is an excellent refuge, and then going backwards. So here it talks about the three distinctive features of a Buddha's realizations. If you want to review this, it's in following in the Buddha's footsteps, page 56. I think it starts with the abandonments, and 56 or 57, 56 and 58 is the realizations. Okay, so, no, I'm sorry, 59 is the realizations. So here, again, excellent realization, irreversible or stable realizations, and complete realizations. Yeah, so just as we had those same three names for the abandonments. Yeah, the abandonments, what the Buddha got rid of and purified. The realizations, what the Buddha accomplished or generated. So the excellent realization is that unlike the non-Buddhas, the Buddha has realized the ultimate nature of reality. So as I mentioned, the non-Buddhists don't meditate on emptiness. So, they haven't realized the ultimate nature of reality. They aren't out of samsara yet. Yeah. Many times people ask me, do you think, can you get enlightened by practicing another spiritual path or another religion? Okay. And I always say, I don't know, because I haven't actualized the final product of my own faith, let alone that of others, to see if they're the same or not. But I often follow that up by saying, as it's usually taught, to gain liberation and to gain full awakening, we need to realize emptiness. So if there's another religion or spiritual path that teaches emptiness, then that one can also lead to liberation. And if they teach bodhicitta as well, even though they don't use the words bodhicitta and emptiness, then it can lead to full awakening. But it's up to us to examine these different spiritual paths and religions to see if they actually teach bodhicitta in its complete form and teach emptiness in its complete form. But if it does, then you can attain those realizations. If not, then you can't, you know. No matter how much one prays, no matter how many offerings one makes and so forth. Okay, those realizations are the real key, you know. But those people can gain an upper rebirth. So that's good. Okay, so excellent realization. Then the second is irreversible or stable realizations. So the Buddha has gained these, and these are realizations that never decline. Again, unlike those of the Shravaka Aryas on the path of seeing and meditation. And also unlike the bodhisattvas on the path of, on the first four paths, okay? First four of the Mahayana paths. And then complete realizations. So again, unlike the Shravaka Arhats, the Buddha is omniscient and has realized all knowable objects and knows the methods to do so. So a Buddha is omniscient. However, a Buddha is not omnipotent. So this is an important point, because people sometimes will ask you, how does the Buddha compare to God? Or is the Buddha just another word for God? Yeah. And so here we have to answer, you know, it depends how you define God. Yeah. Some people define God as the principle of love and compassion. Yes, in Buddhism, we talk about love and compassion. Some people define God as a being who is more spiritually advanced than us, somebody who is omniscient and omnipotent. And we say, well, yes, from the Buddhist viewpoint, the Buddha is omniscient. He knows everything. But the Buddha is not omnipotent. And the Buddha, you know, is not a creator. He doesn't create the experiences that sentient beings have. Because if he were all powerful and could, you know, solve all of our problems, the Buddha's compassion is such that he would have done so already. There would be no reason for us to still be in samsara if the Buddha, through his own power, could liberate us. Yeah. But our liberation is a 50-50 deal. Yeah. Part of it is the Buddha's guidance. The other part is our own effort. The Buddha's guidance is always there. Our own effort, well, we have to check. You know, how much is our own belief, our own faith, our aspiration, our effort activated? Okay, so that's why we say that the Buddha is omniscient, but not omnipotent. And then also, if people, when they're asking about how God and Buddha compare, you know, if you say that God is a creator who created the universe, in Buddhism, we don't have any idea that's comparable to that. Yeah, because why would an all-knowing, compassionate being create samsara? Instead, in Buddhism, our samsara is created by our own ignorance. Yeah, the root is in our own afflictive mind. Okay, so you see, you just take one word here, and then you can talk about one word for a really long time. Yeah, so it says, respectfully, I pay homage. Homage means that you take refuge, you bow, you make offerings. Yeah, you pay obeisance to the Buddha. So it kind of encompasses all of those different activities. We do that. Shantideva says, I'm doing that to the Sugatas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya is the Buddha's truth body. Okay. And it also implies that the Buddha has the Buddha's form bodies. Okay. So sometimes the Buddha's bodies are divided into two, the truth body, the Dharmakaya, and the form body, the Rupakaya. Sometimes they're divided into four, in which case the Dharmakaya has two aspects. One is the omniscient mind of the Buddha, the wisdom Dharmakaya, and the other is the nature Dharmakaya, which has two aspects. One is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, and the other is the true cessations on a Buddha's mind. Okay, and then the Rupakaya, yeah, can be further divided into the enjoyment body, which is the form the Buddha appears in to teach the Arya Bodhisattvas in a pure land, and the emanation body in which the Buddha appears for us ordinary beings. There's different kinds of emanation bodies. Okay, one is the supreme emanation. That's a Buddha who appears in a time of darkness where there's no Buddha Dharma in the world and turns the wheel of Dharma and starts the teachings going in that historical era and in that particular place. Yeah, then there's the artisan. So here a Buddha appears as an artisan to kind of tame the beings of people who think that they are experts. I guess nowadays, instead of saying artisan, we would say he appears as an expert. Because, you know, the usual example is there was an artisan who played the violin and thought he was really great, so the Buddha appeared as a violinist who played better. But now we have scientists and financial consultants and, you know, so many different people who are experts, yeah? And so the Buddha there would appear as an expert who surpasses those experts to lower their arrogance and make them receptive to the path. And then the other kind is just a human being, emanation body. And so that would be like His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, how we consider His Holiness. And there may be many, many other emanation bodies, but they don't wear name tags. So we can't, you know, figure out who they are. And they often appear to be, very confused beings. Or maybe they appear to be ordinary beings who are less confused than us. Okay? And then by the fact of them being less confused than us, we can still identify with them because they look like us and everything. They clearly have more wisdom and, you know, capacity and excellent qualities than we do. So sometimes people ask, if a Buddha has all these miraculous powers, I'm giving you, trying to prepare you to answer the questions that some people will ask you as well to understand for your own side. Why doesn't the Buddha show all of his miraculous power? Because if he did, then everybody would instantly be converted and would follow him, and that would benefit them. That's the question, okay? And the answer is, if Buddha showed all of his miraculous powers, would we really have faith and follow the Buddha's instructions and practice ourselves? Or would we just worship the Buddha? Okay. And so sometimes you see in other spiritual traditions, people who have magical powers, they can make this appear, make that appear. And then people just worship that being. Yeah. They don't think, oh, I want to become like that. And to become like that, I have to tame my own mind and develop compassion and get rid of my anger. People are just, content to worship somebody else, thinking that if they worship a holy being, then they will get the boons or the blessings from that being, and then that will make their life on this planet nice, which is what they want. Okay. But since the Buddha is really trying to steer us towards liberation and awakening, yeah, he doesn't want us just to worship him. He wants us to practice. And so it's for that reason that he doesn't manifest all of these miraculous powers to everybody. Yeah. Sometimes, and you know, it's actually forbidden for those of us who are monastics. If you have these powers, it's a lapse. It's a paisatika. If you demonstrate these powers publicly, and it is a parajika, a defeat, if you lie about these practices and say you have these abilities and you say you have them, or if you do duplicitous activities to make it seem like you have magical abilities, then you lose your ordination completely. Yeah. So the Buddha was not at all interested in showing the magical powers and using that to convert people, because it, you know, the way sentient beings' minds work, it would make people think that, oh, if you have magical powers, then you're awakened. Whereas, you know, some people have magical powers because they have, you know, deep states of samadhi, you know, which is a good achievement, but it's not awakening. And other people have magical powers simply because of the karma they created in previous lives. Yeah, so they don't have any realizations of the path at all. So the Buddha really is always pushing us towards the highest goal. And, you know, if all we can do is advance to the lowest one, that's good. And then he'll bump us up and bump us up, okay? But his ultimate aim is the highest one. Now, somebody's going to say, but, yeah, in the first lunar month, on the full moon, we always celebrate the day of miracles, which was when the Buddha displayed all of his miracle powers to the non-Buddhists, okay, who then converted and became the Buddha's disciples. So you contradicted yourself. See, he showed his magical powers, and it worked just like I said. They converted. Yeah, so you contradicted yourself. Actually, in that story, if you understand the whole story, there were these matted hair ascetics who had deep states of meditation, and they had these magical powers that came from having actualized high levels of samadhi. And they were mistaken and thought they had attained liberation. Yeah. This is one of the defects of getting attached to the bliss of samadhi, is you think you've attained liberation when you haven't. So that was their state. And they challenged the Buddha to a contest of miraculous powers, because in their mind, that was how you proved if you were really enlightened or not. Whoever had the highest miraculous power. So in the case of these particular people, yeah, they had the wrong view and thought they had liberation. And they also thought that having miraculous powers was a sign of being awakened. Okay. And so how is the Buddha going to get through to these people? If he just tells them, your miraculous powers are based on karma, or they're based on you're having samadhi, you're not liberated, you have to go back and really generate the path from the beginning, these guys are going to say, forget it. Who do you think you are telling us? We aren't high and noble, when look, we can make things appear and we can fly in the sky and do all these other things. So don't talk to us. So, how is the Buddha going to, get through to these people? So he kept refusing their challenges for a contest of miraculous power. And finally, he agreed. And then as they had this contest, it became apparent over a series of days how the Buddha's miraculous powers were far superior to those of these matted hair ascetics. So it was by showing those powers, that was the way the Buddha subdued the minds of those particular disciples. Okay? That's why the last of our auxiliary bodhisattva precepts, the one that I never break, is that if you have miraculous powers, not using them if it would benefit and subdue the mind of somebody else. So I never break that, because I don't avoid using my miraculous powers because I don't have them. Okay, so, but you see, in certain conditions, then it's okay if with the bodhicitta motivation, then you do that kind of thing. So a spiritual master, maybe in a very private setting to one or two disciples, might show something, but they don't make it like, okay, now I'm going to show you my, miraculous powers. They don't do it that way. So it's up to the students to be, it's in a very special context where the students are able to notice what's going on. Okay. So, and I've heard stories about His Holiness doing this with different disciples. Okay. So, so that answers that question. Let's come back to the homage. okay. So I respectfully, I pay homage to the Suggathas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya. We've covered that part. As well as to their children. Okay. Children, in Sanskrit and Tibetan, they use the word that translates as sons. Okay. Which includes daughters, as Avalokiteshvara made very clear in the Heart Sutra. Okay. But the meaning of it is actually like an heir. Okay. It's often translated as children. But the meaning is not exactly like an heir, but it's more like an heir in the sense that, and here we get back to ancient Indian culture, where you have the caste system, okay? So if you are born into the ruling caste, okay, then, your father's going to be the king. I don't know. I guess your mother would be the queen. But it's patriarchal, so your dad's in charge. And then the kids, the male heir, the male progeny, would be the heirs to their father. It's kind of like you take over your dad's business. So, and we see this in Western kingdoms. The father dies, and then the son gets crowned king. Yeah, so it's an heir in that sense. And here, what the meaning is in the spiritual sense is that The Buddha's heirs are the bodhisattvas, because the bodhisattvas will advance in their practice and become Buddhas themselves. Okay? So the Buddha's heirs don't usually include the shravakas and solitary realizers. Yeah? If they attain, until they enter the bodhisattva vehicle. Okay? Once they, because those beings will attain arhatship first, then go back and enter the bodhisattva vehicle from the beginning. At that time, they will become the Buddha's heirs, because they will eventually become Buddhas. Okay? But that gets into different assertions of different schools. Some schools say there's three final vehicles. Okay? So that you either, you know, once you attain arhatship as a shravaka or arhatship as a solitary realizer, that's it. You never become a bodhisattva. So there's three final vehicles, the third one being the bodhisattva vehicle. The other traditions say, no, there's one final vehicle. Everybody will eventually enter the bodhisattva vehicle. Okay. At one of the recent monastic gatherings that I went to, you know, we were discussing the qualities of the Buddha, and this point came out. And when somebody explained the usual Mahayana way of talking about this, our Theravada friends were very offended. Okay. And it is offensive. Yeah, it is offensive. You know, because somebody said, you know, they attain arhatship and they're in their, you know, peaceful liberation. So that the Theravada friends would agree with. But then we go on to say, but they haven't eliminated the cognitive obscurations. So the Buddha has to wake them up from their meditative equipoise so they can enter the Mahayana vehicle. And that, the idea of you waking up an arhat who has attained liberation, oh, that one caused, yeah. So don't say that when you're talking to our Theravada friends. You know, it just functions to close people's minds. And, you know, and what we want to do is really create harmony. Because the way it is often described in certain Mahayana sutras, it really is a very extreme way, you know. And sometimes, you know, the commentaries are extreme in that way, too. Because the commentaries are trying to, again, you know, make you aim for Buddhahood at the beginning, because it said that it's a quicker way if you enter the bodhisattva vehicle directly rather than first becoming an arhat and then later entering the bodhisattva vehicle. Yeah, so they do that for a reason. But, you know, to say this to our Theravada friends who are practicing very well, yeah, and many of whom themselves you know, I have Theravada friends who have taken the Bodhisattva vows. I have one Theravada friend who's taken tantric initiation and practices tantra. So, you know, we can't draw nice, neat, clean lines and about things, and we don't want to really offend anybody. That's not helpful at all. Okay. Also, sometimes the sutras and the commentaries, Mahayana sutras and commentaries, make it sound like the Theravadas, well, they use the term Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle or more modest vehicle, which I never, ever, ever use. And His Holiness, I mean, if his translators follow the way His Holiness want it done, they never say Hinayana. They say fundamental vehicle, because it's the basis of the Mahayana practice. It's the basis of all Buddhism. So it's got to be really something we honor and respect and practice ourselves. Okay? But It makes it sound, sometimes the Mahayana things make it sound like, oh, all those people are Hinayanas. They're totally selfish. You know, they just think about themselves and their own liberation. They're selfish. Not like us, we practice the Mahayana and we're aiming for Buddhahood and we are so compassionate. You know, if you're a real bodhisattva, then you're entitled to say that. But a real bodhisattva would not be arrogant about it. A real bodhisattva would be humble. Okay. When you look at how people practice, you have to look individually. And, you know, how many of the people who follow the Mahayana are actual bodhisattvas? When you compare the ordinary people who follow Mahayana and the ordinary people who follow the fundamental vehicle, how much difference is there between how we act? Yeah, because we're all overwhelmed by ignorance, anger, and attachment. So there, what is the difference in how we act? It's going to be an individual difference according to the practitioner and how well they practice and the extent to which they've tamed their ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment. Okay. I remember, just this is one small incident, but it really remained in my mind. Okay. So one time I was invited by a Tibetan center to go to their country and give some teachings. But it happened that I paid the ticket with the understanding that they would reimburse because that's what's always done. I got to that place and I was giving teachings at several different centers, at the Tibetan center and also at some Theravada centers and general Mahayana centers. Anyway, the people from the Tibetan center said, no, we're not going to reimburse your airfare. And I was like, oh, you know, you mean I have to pay for my international airfare to come and teach you? You know, I was really kind of stuck because I didn't have much money, but okay, they don't want to pay, what to do? Then one day I'm teaching at a Theravada center. Okay, these are the people who are selfish. Yeah, remember? And the abbot of the center came and he handed me an envelope and he said, this is for your airfare. And I was shocked because how in the world, I said, how did he know that the other center didn't pay my airfare? How did he know? And then even if he knew to give the airfare from, you know, their center, I was like really totally overwhelmed by that kind of generosity and compassion. Okay. So it's just a small story, but what it emphasizes is it's really up to the individual practice and that we should never, ever be arrogant about practicing the Mahayana vehicle, okay? And when we become bodhisattvas, of course, we're never going to be arrogant. Bodhisattvas are the humblest of all, you know. So that abbot may have been, that Theravada abbot may have been the bodhisattva in the picture, okay? I have no idea how he found out about that, yeah? But it really touched me. Okay, well, we did two lines. Yeah? which explain the short expression of worship. Oh, no, I didn't finish. Okay, as well as their children, so their heirs, and all those who are worthy of offerings. Does it say? Worthy of homage. So this includes, you know, all the Shravakas, the learners, and the Arhats. And, you know, everybody really who is creating virtue. when they're creating virtue. When those people are creating non-virtue, they're not objects of homage. Okay. So we have a few minutes for Q&A.
Is a comment on the Theravada, thing. I was really surprised to see that this organization that started the oath to combat student-teacher abuse was a Theravadan organization.
No, it's a new organization. Yeah, she started a new organization.
Oh, well, then the other organization that signed it.
The other organization besides us so far was the Australian Sangha Association, which includes Theravada, General Mahayana, and Tibetan.
Okay. The video was a Theravadan monk.
Yeah, it was a Theravada monk who spoke on behalf of the whole association, but the association represented all of the Buddhists in Australia. I think that's really nice, actually, in Australia, that they have one big, national thing. Any other question?
Those Buddhists, when they manifest as the expert or artists in bodies, is there also the function do they function also to teach Dharma through their art or through their expertise?
I don't know.
Not having learned Bodhisattva paths and grounds, I wonder how would we map that onto the three excellent abandonments? Like at what? So to get the proper abandonment, you would be...
Okay, so for the excellent one, you haven't entered a path at all. The first one, yeah, on both sides, for excellent, whether it's abandonment or realization, you haven't entered the path at all. And then for the other two, you've become an Arya, so which means path of seeing.
Mm-hmm. Tuche is asking, what is a skillful way to correct someone who's using the word Hinayana?
Ooh, it depends on many circumstances. If you know the person, if they're a friend, and it's a private situation, you can say, that term, you always start out with, you may not know this, but that term means this and that, and it's offensive to some beings. So His Holiness Dalai Lama uses fundamental vehicle. Okay? That's to somebody you know well, who is receptive in a private situation. Somebody that you don't know well, and in a public situation, people do not like being corrected in public. And they don't like being corrected when, if they're in, like when they're giving teachings or something, and if you're with a Tibetan teacher and they say Hinayana and you raise your hand, Rinpoche, Geshe La, don't say Hinayana. That's not respectful. Okay, so don't do it in that situation. Yeah, but if it's a friend, and you have that kind of way, because they may not know, and then you can just kind of say that to them. Yeah. All these kinds of things, so much depends. Do you hear the word depends a lot? There's no blanket. You always do things like this. It depends on the situation and on the person and on many conditions. Okay.